Alan, my name's Yvonne and I am an alcoholic. Can everybody hear me? Oh. Hi, my name's Yvonne and I'm an alcoholic. Is that better? Right. I'm really, really grateful to be here, and it's a real privilege to sit up here and be asked to speak, and I really would like to thank the committee for asking me. I am mean, selfish and egotistical by nature. I know that because I have no problem sitting up here. I'm quite comfortable. A few years ago I was asked to do a similar thing at the Southern Convention when it was at Canberra Sands. My sponsor put my name down for it and phoned me up and told me I was doing it and what day I was to be there. So I duly showed up, and there were four of us on the top table, and there was a man also sharing at the same time, and he was extremely nervous and very, you know, physically very nervous. He shook and he was sweating, and we sat in the little room before you go out on the stage, and he was sharing with me how he felt. And all I could think of, and I'd looked out on the stage, all I could think of was that I wore an orange top and the curtains were red and I clashed with the curtains. So that is the, you know, that is the ego and the self-centeredness. And it serves me well on times like this, because as I say, I don't suffer from that fear and nervousness. There was discussion yesterday about types of alcoholic, and you know, the type of alcoholic who wants to climb to the top of the heap and the type who wants to bury themselves underneath. And I spent 35 years trying to be on the top of the heap that I've created, you know, and I don't want either today. I don't have a need or a want or a desire. It's not God's will for me to be either on the top or either on the bottom. You know, God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous almost 12 years ago now. I was brought along by a very lovely lady who my husband had made contact through with the telephone office, because he had a real desire for me to stop drinking. So being the compliant person that I could be at times, and to get the heat off of me, I came along to, I had no desire to stop drinking whatsoever. I came along to an AA meeting and this lovely lady told me that I was helping keep her sober. Well, I love to help people. I'm a compulsive saviour. So I thought, well, I better keep coming to these meetings, because I'm obviously, I mean, I think she was 6 or 7 years sober at the time. I better come to the meetings because I'm really helping her. And I came to meetings and I identified with people's drinking. I remember a number of years ago in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, with good recovery and a good spiritual life as part of my daily living, thinking that I didn't need to talk about my drinking, that I only needed to talk about my recovery and my spiritual life, my relationship with God. And my sponsor very lovingly pointed out to me that you know, the common bond which binds us together is, you know, it's really step one, that powerlessness over alcohol and that unmanageability, that mental obsession of the mind and that physical allergy when I put alcohol into my system. If you don't identify with anything else I say today, if you are an alcoholic, you will identify with that. You know, I found myself drunk when I did not want to be drunk, drinking when I had no intention of drinking at all, and then all the things that went with it, stealing money to buy drink that I didn't want. The love affair ended for me very quickly at the end of my drinking. But I'd had 19 years of, it wasn't a honeymoon at the time, I would have said it was, I'd had 19 years of functioning alcoholism. And I functioned really well. And that lady who I was helping keep sober used to say to me, Yvonne, the shop window looks really nice, but what's going on in the stock room? And I knew for the first time that someone had seen through, because I put on good front, you know, facade and show, no problem at all. The actor on the stage, that is me to a T. And I came to meetings, you know, suit up and show up, and I did that. I didn't say anything, but she saw she was an alcoholic like me, and she knew what was going on, but I didn't. You know, that was the thing. She saw in me what I hadn't even got the perception or the intelligence, I suppose, and I did think I was quite intelligent. I had no awareness, no self-awareness at all. I truly thought My philosophy on life was that I would do anything for anybody. That was my catchphrase. If I was asked to describe me in one phrase, that would be the phrase I would have used. And there was a real big element of truth in that I would do anything for anybody. If you were my friend, I mean, I'd had loads of friends over the year. I'd never sustained friendships, but I'd made loads of them, and they lasted, and they were very intense, and they were very, you know, full on friendships. And I mean, relationships with men, I could do a whole other chair on that one as well. But it was, everything was very, I met people and I never grew to know people. I never took time to develop relationships. It was always 100% right from the word go. And it always ended in tears, because I often met and was attracted to people who were similar or just like me. And eventually we burnt each other out. And I remember when I met the man I eventually married, and we'd been dating for a while, and I think maybe we were getting engaged, and he said that he was still friends with his very, very first girlfriend he'd had when he was 16, and he was actually godfather to her first child. And I was horrified. I thought, God, that is really sick. That is just really sick behaviour, you know, there's something wrong with that. Because with me, if I'd been, you know, you didn't darken my door again, nor I yours. If we'd had a friendship relationship, whatever type, whether it was, with another woman, whether it was with a man, the line was firmly drawn underneath it, and that part of my life and your life was ended. But I truly thought, because I am so egotistical, that everybody else lived their life in a similar fashion to mine. And I'd never ever, there's one of the wonderful philosophers that's actually said that the unexamined life is not a life worth living. And I'd never ever, ever examined my life. I'd never stood still. I was a very active alcoholic. I was hyperactive. I never stood still for long enough to look back at an hour ago, let alone to look back at yesterday or a year ago or 5 years ago. I was forging forward and ahead all the time. So I came to the meetings with this lady, stayed around for 3 months, and did so identify with the drinking. Women's drinking stories, I really did. I had no problem with identifying with. And then people would talk about this stuff, and they called it recovery, and I hadn't got a clue what it was. And it seemed to me, and this is the perception of the mind of this alcoholic, that the drinking stories were kind of semi-funny, semi-tragic, semi-whatever, and I could relate. And then you got sober, and then it got really hard, and life was very difficult. And this, there's no reflection at all on the meetings I went to. This is solely the perception and the mind of this alcoholic, and what I saw, what I chose to see. So I stopped coming. And picked a drink up intentionally. I wasn't suddenly overwhelmed with a desire to pick a drink up. I was bored with AA, and I didn't think, because I'd come for 3 months and I hadn't had in all that 3 months a kind of knowledgeable craving for a drink. I was hearing people talk about craving a drink, and I wasn't craving a drink. I thought, that means I'm not an alcoholic, so it's all right to drink. So I started to drink again, and therein began a very rapid, and I thank God for it, you know, a very swift decline into the terrible early stages, actually, of chronic alcoholism. I was very, very sick very, very quickly. And by God's grace, and everything I say today is really by God's grace. God's grace, I was given a second chance. I was hospitalised, and what happened for me was I came to in a hospital directly as a result of my drinking. And as my eyes opened the following morning, I saw this had to be changed. I think Bill says that in his story. That's not actually his last dream, but he's, you know, I saw this had to be changed. I knew that there was something wrong. And I couldn't be, you know, that alcoholic tornado and bluster my way out of the hospital and bluster my way back into the family and pretend that everything was okay and it would all be all right again. I just knew I was defeated and deflated. That huge ego, which, you know, is still there in varying sizes, had a hole punctured in it. And what happened for me was I was told that I wasn't well in the hospital and that I needed to speak to a psychiatric nurse. And for what happened when I knew I was going to see this person, a little voice came on in my head and it said, Yvonne, be honest. I don't think my head had ever said that. I'm not sure. In fact, I know it hadn't. I mean, it just wasn't part of my philosophy of life, being honest. So I sat down opposite this man and I was as rigorously honest with him as I could be, and he told me I was very sick and I needed to go away somewhere. So that's what honesty does for you. But I went away and I was put in a safe place for a month, and I went in to this place on a bank holiday weekend. I was the only patient in there. There was nobody else there, apart from the staff. Everybody was well enough to be allowed home. So what I had was something I hadn't made the use of for years and years. I had the gift of time. There was no children, no husband, no drink, no anything, nothing to do. I'm a real doer. And what also happened was somebody, and this, you know, the kindness of fellow AAs, somebody took time out from their bank holiday weekend and they drove to the hospital and they brought me in a big book. Now, I'd bought a big book, but I'd never read it. I had read it as far as the inscription on the tomb in Winchester Cathedral, and I thought, what a load of old twaddle, and I threw the book into the back of a wardrobe. But somebody brought me a copy of the big book and told me that this was a program. They weren't saying, do you want to do the steps? And they weren't saying, are you ready or anything? I mean, I was sitting in a psychiatric hospital, so I suppose it was pretty obvious that, step one had kicked in. And they said to me, Yvonne, this is a program of learning to walk with God. And if you want to walk with God, you've got to talk to God. And the problem you've got is in the pages of that book, and so is the solution. And I don't know why, I'd never been teachable with anything. I was one of those, you tried to tell me something, and I said, I know, I cut you off. I told you, oh, yes, sure, and I didn't even know what you were talking about. I had to know everything because it was the only way I felt secure, I suppose. And this person left, and I was left with the big book, and I read the doctor's opinion, and the doctor's opinion just told me what was wrong with it. Identified my problem, why when I started drinking with the short, absolute, heartfelt, steadfast intention of stopping after the third or the fourth, I was absolutely powerless to do so. I went on to read Bill's story and his encounter with who I now know to be Ebbie Thatcher, of coming to him and saying that you've got to get God. I mean, Ebbie said he'd got religion, but it was about having a relationship with God. And I had been an absolute, I was an ardent atheist. I wasn't an agnostic. I wasn't a skeptic. I was a complete atheist. I had no belief. The one belief I'd had all my life was I really, really, really believed in me. Truly believed in me. I believed in my abilities. I believed, ego. Bill says it so well. I who thought so well of my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles. That's me by nature. I think I can do that. I can do this. I can do everything. There's nothing I can't do. And my life in many areas bore that out. If I wanted something, and it was usually by dishonesty, it wasn't by fair means and hard work. It was usually by scheming and manipulating, dishonesty and plotting and scheming and planning. I got what I wanted. And the reality of that for me for 35 years, it would satisfy me for a while. And that could be anything. I'm not just talking about drink and substances. I'm talking about, men, cars, houses. I knew how to feed people the lines to get the results that I wanted. I was very, very manipulative. There was, something that was read out description of the word selfish, and it says that about pleasure seeking, and I just sought my own pleasure. I thought, if I enjoy it, it must be good. If it's good, it must be fun, and if it's fun, I just want more of it. And that was that's the philosophy. Probably I've got adolescents in my family, and that's a philosophy that perhaps most adolescents have, but adults actually tend to grow out of that, and I hadn't. I was 35 and that was still my belief. So God, just the word God, as it says in the book, I bristled with antagonism in those early meetings when I'd heard the word God. I had a real physical reaction and rejection of it. And I wouldn't, honestly, open-mindedness and willingness. I had no time for anything, no time for spiritual matters, as it says. And at that point, the person went off who brought me the big book, and I'd got as far as Bill being told, you've got to get God, really, and it can be a God as you understand him. And I asked if I could go for a walk, and I went for a walk, and I had no problems. My head chattered. There was quite a bit of talk here at the top table today about the chatter in the head. Mine had chattered for as long as I can remember. There were conversations in there, there were books I was going to write, there were letters I was going to write. I mean, I never did any of those things, but, you know, it was full of vain wanderings and imaginations of different things I was going to do. And, you know, those wonderful one-line revenge sentences I was going to say to the people who'd harmed me along the way. And I'm such a coward, I never said any of them, but I got real kind of ego boost and real kind of smug self-satisfaction from playing the scene out in my head. I lived in my head. I absolutely lived in it. And I went for a walk and I said my childhood had been through a particular religious denomination, and I was taught prayers and how to pray. And as a very small child, although I was an atheist, I did have that childlike faith that there was something bigger than me. But I threw the baby out with the bathwater at a very young age. So I went for a walk and I said the first prayer that I'd ever said with meaning. And all I said, and the first words, and they're the most important words I can say today, they're the most important words I start anything with, and it is God. And that's all I said. I went along and I said, God, I'm here. I mean, I didn't get on my knees, I didn't do any of that. And all I knew, and I cannot put it into words that will convey it, I knew I was heard and I knew somebody was listening to me. And I did feel a sense of calm, and I went back to my room and I phoned the lady up that I was helping keep sober by going to the meetings. I phoned her up and asked her to be my sponsor. I wasn't even sure what a sponsor was or what they did, but I thought I need a sponsor. And she agreed. And I left the place that I was in after a couple of weeks. And what happened for me, and I know this is about steps 10 and 11, was I did a step four with this lady, and we did do it in the form of a life story. And at that point, you know, I was praying, talking to God on a regular basis. I wasn't meditating, but I was getting on my knees every morning, and I was having conscious contact with God, because I'd made that contact on that day I'd walked. And I knew that there was a God. You know, it wasn't up for debate that I'd resigned from the debating society. And we did the step four and five in the form of a life story, and it wasn't worthless and it wasn't useless. But what it didn't give me, which I now know that I needed in the time to come, was it didn't give me the tools to carry this message to the next alcoholic. What it gave me, it did give me self-knowledge, but self-knowledge, you know, is not a power greater than me. Self-knowledge is still me. I loved what one of the speakers said today, and they talked about, you know, I think he said something along the lines of, you know, being brought into hospital almost dead and thinking then that I have to go into that sick mind to find the answer. You know, my solution to alcoholism is not in my thinking. It's really, really not, because I have the mind of an alcoholic. My solution is in the spirit, and my solution is God. I worked through the rest of the steps, you know, and I was happy, joyous and free. I've been happy, joyous and free from that first day when I took that walk and said that to, you know, God, I'm checking in type of prayer. And then what happened was my sponsor left Alcoholics Anonymous for personal reasons. And I had no sponsor for a while, and my family were growing up. I had three children and a husband and a home, and I was, you know, had commitments in AA, and I was working, and I was praying, and I've never ceased praying, and I've never ceased, you know, conscious contact with God is just a sense of God's presence throughout the day. And I can, you know, if I put the work in the morning, my experience has been that God is with me all day. You know, God isn't with me just conditionally, just if I'm, you know, the childish things, if I'm being good, if I'm behaving myself, if I'm doing the right thing. God is there. You know, God is my heavenly Father. I'm a parent to three children, and I don't walk out the door when they behave in a way that I perhaps might not approve of. And then what happened was my eldest son was growing up, and he went away for a particular weekend to Norwich to stay with a friend and the friend's auntie. And to be honest, he was quite a handful, and I have to be honest, selfishness, self-centeredness, you know, I have to look at my part. I was quite glad that he was going away for a weekend. It was quite nice just to have the two, you know, the two babies almost, the two younger boys who were very, very manageable. So my Louis went off to the weekend for Norwich, and at 3 o'clock on the Sunday morning, In fact, no, I think it was the Saturday morning, I got a phone call from Norwich Police Station to say, we've got your 15-year-old son in custody. He's had a car accident, and he was in a car with a friend, the friend that he'd gone up with. And as in Louis's words, as he said to me, Mum, the lady we went to stay with was an alcoholic, but she hasn't been one for 2 years. But my Louis went and stayed with her for a weekend, and she was one again, so... I don't know what that would tell you. But I drove up to Norwich in, I'll tell you the amazing thing about this program. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know where Norwich is. Never been there. I know it's that bit that sticks out with a funny shape in England. I had no idea. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I thought, I cannot find Norwich of a night time. I'm not even sure I can find it of a day. I put the phone down. I said to the policeman, I will come up in the morning when it's light. I will drive up. I put the phone down. I prayed and I let go and handed my son into God's arms and God's hands. And I went back to sleep for about 3 hours. You know, that's just, you know, that is amazing. That is God's gift of you know, sobriety, really, of reality. And I got up the next day and went to Norwich, collected my lovely son, who was all dressed in a paper suit, and he's as tall as me and thinner than me, so he was pretty outstanding, and he insisted that he wasn't going to put his normal civilian clothes on, because he really thought he was like the gangster rat man of the whole of England at this time, in his paper suit. And halfway back down the motorway with him, he was totally unrepentant. We had Kiss FM on at about 100 decibels, which was just really jarring. And I said to him, Louis, I think we'll pull over and we'll have a drink in a cafe. So we pulled into a cafe, never been there before, called the Comfort Cafe. And I was sitting there with my cup of coffee, and Louis was sitting there all angry and agitated and not happy. And I looked up, and there was a man walked in with an AA t-shirt on. And I thought, oh, that's amazing. So I went up and I said to him, hi, I'm a friend of Bill W's. And he shook my hand and he said, come on, you must meet my wife. And therein was my next sponsor, and I, you know, that lady sitting here today. So began my journey, and that's why I say it, because we went back to the big book. She told me I had to do a big book study, and I'm thinking, yeah, but I've been sober 5 or 6 years, I don't need to do a big book study. And I did read the book, and she actually gave me a study to do, and told me how to put it in a folder, and what I had to do, and told me I had a set amount of time to do it, and I was going to spend the weekend with her when I'd done it, and we were going to do a step 4 and 5 in the columns and the written infantry. And I went ahead and did that, and so began another layer, another level of my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what that gave me, it gave me a much fuller knowledge of my condition, and it gave me the courage to sit here and to share my experience, my strength, and my hope of what God has done for me in my life today. Step 10. You know, lots of talk, you know, lots of things about, you know, written infantry. I loved what the guy was saying about, you know, there's too many trees dying with all the written infantry. And I am in conscious contact with my God. I spend time in the morning. The most valuable tool in my spiritual toolbox is an alarm clock. And I have to say, when the speaker said he got up at 4:30, I get up early. I do not get up at 4:30, but I do get up early in the morning. And I make time and take time to spend time with God, because it's about having a relationship with God. You know, there's people in this room today that I have a relationship with. There's people in this room that I don't know, that I've never met before today, and I can see you, and I can know perhaps that you know, you might have come from same or different backgrounds to me, and hopefully you're here because you've got the common problem. But I haven't got a relationship with you as such, but I've got a relationship with the people I spend time with. And that's what God asked me to do, is just to give some of that time. You know, as the speaker said, there's 24 hours in the day. I had a complete inability, as it says in step 10, to admit that I was wrong. Ego. Unable, completely. I could say sorry for England. I could say I am sorry. I am so sorry. I am really sorry. I am truly sorry. I had more adjectives to go in front of the word sorry than, well, what? And I was, as far as I knew it. But really, the self-seeking and the self-centeredness and the selfishness in my sorries was really what I meant was, please forgive me. Please still like me. Please don't judge me. I didn't mean it. Now, that's very, very childish and immature behaviour. And I was 35 and I'd still behave that way. You know, I had a phone account with Interflora, because that was like my way of saying sorry. I would come to your home and I didn't wreck anyone's parties. I made a complete arse of myself because I was drinking and because of my behaviour. You know, I suddenly thought every man in the room was magnetised to me, and it was my God-given duty to spread myself around. But they weren't. Believe you me, they weren't. And I would send flowers, would be flying off around various parts of London on a Sunday or a Monday morning with, you know, huge bouquets, expensive bouquets, with big sorry words in them. And I did mean it, and I used to think I'll never ever do that again. But I could not admit I was wrong. And where the huge divide came for me was, I would be like that to you and to you and to you and everyone in this room. But heaven help you if you were basically a blood relative. If you were my husband, if you were my mother, if you were one of my three children, and especially my eldest son, he was my absolute scapegoat. If you were any of those people, you got nothing from me at all. You really, because I had nothing to give, and the little I did have to give, which was fueled by self, was given to everybody outside the home. And it says in the big book, you know, the alcoholic, more than most people, not unlike most people or different, but more to the extreme of most people, leads a double life. And I led a hugely double life. I was, you know, outside the home, I could be thoughtful and kind and caring and smiley and generous and all those things. I could be. And the front door shut, and I was mean, and I was selfish, and I was egotistical, and I had a foul mouth on me, and I had a heavy hand on me with my eldest son, and I was a very, very difficult person to live with. But you see, the people outside the home thought I was lovely, so it really served me well, because they would say, you know, you're a good mum, or you're good this, you're good that, because I fed the people the lines and projected the image I wanted you to see. And I knew myself that there was this huge divide between the two. You know, my life was very, very much split down the middle. And, you know, what God's grace has done for me is God has entered my heart, and he has given me the capacity through his power. You know, I cannot do God's will on my power. I've tried many times, you know, been good intentioned, with good will, with thoughts of kindness. But if it's coming from my alcoholic mind, and it's not coming from, as I understand it to be, my, you know, my spiritual toolbox, my spirit, which is my relationship with God, then I'm still really self-will run riot. And self-will run riot can still look really good. It can, you know, it doesn't have to look mean and selfish and egotistical. It doesn't have to look fearful and self-seeking. It doesn't have to look any of those things. A shop window can still look really, really good. But internally, I know. And what I've learned, you know, through you know, step 10 and step 11, I always think of them as being, you know, intertwined, really. It's through prayer and meditation. And I still find the prayer much easier. I'm a much better talker than I am a listener. But through prayer, which is talking to God, and meditation, which is listening to God, and it's just being still and being quiet. You know, I've gone down various routes there was talk today about, you know, seeking God sort of, you know, out there. And it's not. It's my relationship with God, and it's an internal spiritual condition. So I set my alarm clock in the morning, and I get up in the morning, and I spend a set time with God in the morning before anybody else in my house has got up. And boy, oh boy, do I, you know, I am, for somebody who really believed they were spontaneous and, you know, wanted to kind of live this wild sort of undisciplined, free-spirited life, I'm a real creature of habit. You know, I need that. It talks about discipline. We allow God to discipline us. And, you know, I am, Monday to Friday, I am really good at my practice, if I can call it that. Weekends I'm okay, but send me on holiday for a fortnight and I go sort of whatever, because I'm usually, as we went away this year, you know, and I was sharing a room with my children, and my routine was completely out of kilter. I didn't lose my conscious contact with God, but what I lost was my discipline of morning time on my own. And what happened for me recently as well was, about 3 weeks ago, my middle son got himself a paper round, which is all very lovely, but he happens to get up for his paper round right in the middle of my prayer and meditation. And I had to smile, because I identified, I have a knowledge of my condition, the workings of my mind. And when he told me he'd got the paper round, I could have identified, I could have so easily become, you know, the spiritual giant who's praying, and as the sharer shared earlier, you know, the wife calls from the other room three times, and on the third time you shout and say, can't you see I'm meditating, leave me alone. And I identified that as a probable obstacle, and I've just had to do some rearranging, and it's okay, you know, I have got the ability to be flexible today. I didn't have that at all. You know, throughout the day I've spoken about that conscious contact with God, and I truly believe in our big book there are the most, there's the, you know, the step three prayer, freedom from the bondage of self. And why do I ask for it? You know, so that I won't damage other people's spirits, because that's what, you know, when I looked at the harm done others, some of it was physical, some of it was financial, you know, a lot of it was emotional around the children, but really it was spiritual, you know. And if I accept that I'm a child of God, I have no right to damage the spirit of another human being today, because it doesn't belong to me, it belongs to God. And I rode roughshod, you know, okay, in ignorance, but I did, I rode roughshod over the feelings of other human beings. And when I take my infantry today during the day, it says, you know, that I'm not going to be inspired at all times. I know it talks in the big book about being early on, but, you know, I'm not early on and I'm not inspired at all times. But what I do have is, with the conscious contact, I have the ability to say, and they're two of the most wonderful tiny little prayers in the book, and one is, God, save me from being angry. And every time, I can honestly say from my heart, when I've done that, it really, really works. And the other one for me is, God, direct my thinking. Now they all start with God, and it's almost as soon as I say the word God, God does do for me what I cannot do for myself. And I'll share with you, because I think my memory for now, I'm an experiential, I'd love to talk like in theory about steps, and I can only share my experience, strength and hope with you. But you know, experientially, I'll share some of the wonderful things. You know, this life that God has given me has been such a challenge in a fantastic way, because every day is a new beginning, and every day I can open my eyes and think, what's God got for me? I remember my sponsor saying to me, you have no more problems anymore, Yvonne. You have opportunities on a daily basis to look for God's solutions. And that just puts a whole, it's almost saying that, but it was a whole different slant on my outlook and my attitude on life. And I could be like that person in a very Pollyanna way, where, you know, the tornado person, where I thought, I've got no problems, and the family were left in this, you know, the wake of a big ship that had ridden right through the middle of the family life. And I realised that it wasn't that sort of, you know, ignorance is bliss type of experience. But what she was telling me was that, you know, if I have conscious contact with God and grow and enlarge my spiritual life. And the spiritual life is not a theory, it's not, I have to live it. I have to live it 24 hours a day if I want to live at peace and be happy in this world. And I've got, you know, so many, I call them my spiritual jewels, you know, so many experiences over the years. I remember when I'd been a few years sober, and I'd be, you know, one of the most wonderful things for me was I've spoken about friendships, was I've got wonderful friends in AA, but I also have wonderful friends I've developed outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. They have, they're not AAs, they don't belong here, they have no, you know, spiritual malady as such. And my two younger sons started school, and I've got friends that have grown up with my boys as their friends and family friends, and it's been wonderful. And I remember when seven years ago, one of the mums at school asked me, did I know anyone who would childmind her son for her? So I said to her, I can't think of anyone offhand, but I'll try and find out. I'll do a bit of networking for you amongst the mums. So I put her in touch with one lady, and the lady that did do it wasn't going to be doing it anymore. There was another lady. And I used to pray, you know, it says that we can pray for things, and we can pray for other people when they might be helped. And I just used to say this lady's name and say, you know, please help her find a proper person to look after this little boy. And I prayed this prayer a few times in the mornings, and everybody that I'd tried to connect her with, there were reasons. One woman couldn't do the school holidays, and this lady worked full time and needed holiday binding as well. And I got down on my knees and I said, you know, Baba, please help this lady find somebody. And this voice, and it wasn't a voice that came from over there, it was an internal voice, it just went, you do it. I thought, get off. I've got three children of my own. I've got an elder boy who was very challenging at that time. And this child had a reputation, is the other thing. And I thought, I've got my own baggage. Selfish program. I don't need somebody else's, whatever. And I prayed, I've identified that. That's self-will. That's me wanting to rescue again. That's me wanting to help. That's me wanting to say. And a voice said to me then, you might offer and she might say no. There's me running with it, thinking, well, she'll be delighted to have me as her childminder for her son. So I didn't do anything. And next morning, the same thing, you do it. So I thought, well, if it's God's will, I will ask. And if it's not God's will, she'll say no, or I don't think that's a good idea. So I asked this lady, how about me? And she said, that would be absolutely fantastic. I can't believe you've offered. And for 5 years, I watched that little boy grow from a little boy. I'll share this with you, and it's one of those things, I've shared, I am an egomaniac, but this isn't about a goal achieved, this isn't about a race, this is just about God's grace, it really, really is. That little boy had a really difficult reputation in school. He was an unhappy little man, and I didn't, what did I do? I did nothing to him. I did nothing. I treated him with love, because I'd learnt to love my own children. And he came to me, and he came to me, and he came to me, and he'd been coming to me, came every morning, and we took him to school. He was in the same class as my youngest son, so it wasn't like a real onerous job. He came home and he stayed with me till 6:30, and went off with his mum. And I took him into school, and on this particular day a teacher came out and said, can I have a word with you? And she said to me, what have you done to this little boy? We can't believe the change in him. Now, I'm not saying, things are much settled. I'm not saying I'm a miracle worker, please don't. I'm not saying, but it's got, what God does is he gets self and me out of the way, and I don't have to be an obstacle to anybody else's growth. And that little boy's a big boy now. He's not a little boy anymore, and he's turned into a lovely young man. And God assigned me. All I have to do is the role God assigns me, and God assigned me a little role, tiny little role in that young man's life, and I'm grateful. As my own children were growing, I've had to learn to change and adapt. And to ask God's will, because what was God's will for me as a mum when they were, 2 and 3 and 7 is not God's will for me now that they're 21 and 14 and 12. They're growing into young men. And I pray on a daily basis. My children, this morning, my children told me I had too much time on their hands, because I had a sense of humour, but my sense of humour was nearly always at the expense of other people. There was always, I love that phrase in the literature where it says about, a polite form of character assassination. I would help you to know somebody slightly better, but really underneath I was trying to put them down to raise myself up. And I really, really don't have to do that today. And if I say I take inventory with my children, I talk to my children. I don't just say I did that and I was wrong. I talk through them what was wrong. And a little while ago, my youngest son had got a new friend at school. And the new friend's sister had a reputation. And she'd been in an awful lot of trouble, and she was obviously a troubled young lady. And I said to Harry, what do you feel about this? I said, because his sister's got a reputation. And I've never been one. I've never chosen friends. I've never whatever said you make friends with that one or whatever. I mean, that's really, that is a God job. But I was obviously getting a little bit busy around it. So I decided I'd share the benefit of my wisdom with my youngest son. And he turned around and he said to me, and I had to thank him for this, because he said to me, Mum, how would you feel? No, he said, Mum, you're a hypocrite. right? It's a big word for a 12-year-old. And I thought, what's he talking about? And he said, how would you feel if people didn't want me to play with their children because my brother is in prison? Because part of my eldest son's journey at that particular time was a stay at Her Majesty's pleasure. And, you know, I said to him, I'm really grateful that you told me that, because I couldn't see that at the time. You know, the teachers in this program come in all forms and all guises. And my eldest son, as I just said, eventually the consequences of his actions caught up with him, but in a most wonderful way, because he was heading out of control on you know, many substances and fixes. And I sort of hung on to him, and it was fingertip hanging on, you know, real fingertip hanging on. And eventually, at the age of 20, last June, he left home. And within a short space of time, he'd got drunk and he'd lost his temper on a bus, which he doesn't remember. And for a very first offence, he went up into court and he was given 6 months sentence, custodial sentence, in the Young Offenders Institution. And it was absolutely the best thing that ever happened to him. Because it didn't, you know, I'd love to say, I mean, I went to visit him and sent him his money and did the duty side of it. And when I went to visit him, I was in anticipation of him saying, oh, this is so awful, Mum, I never want to come back, I'm going to turn my life around. He didn't. All he said is, it's so monotonously mind-numbingly boring in here that I just can't wait to come home. So he came out at the end, and it has changed him. That experience has changed him. And I actually had an option at a point in that to go back to court, and because of circumstances, it would have been so easy to have him released. But I knew it was God's will for him to be there. And we did have a really peaceful Christmas without him, I have to say. And this Christmas, and then 12 months on, you know, miracles happen. Miracles, there's the miracle of the years of recovery, and there's the miracles, you know, God is a God of miracles, and miracles happen at a rapid rate sometimes. This Christmas, he's got a beautiful girlfriend, he's moved into a flat on his own, with his girlfriend together. He's decorating, and he's painting, and he's got a job, and he's just doing, like, really okay. And he's a different person. And for some reason, you know, I remember, as I think parents that who are alcoholics or addicts do, you know, looking for perhaps the signs or whatever. And yeah, it was his drinking that had got him in there. But I don't believe that he is an alcoholic of my type. I really don't. And he's doing amazingly well. And this Christmas, he's coming to stay with his girlfriend, with the family, for Christmas. And that is truly, truly a miracle. I'm just going to check the time because I don't want to go over. And I'm going to go back to step 10 actually. Continue to take personal inventory, and it has to be personal. It's all about me. It's my inventory. It's looking at my my reactions and my actions during the day. What I never realised when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I truly thought I was as I said before, a free spirit, that I chose everything. I thought I chose every drink, I thought I chose every man, I thought I chose this, chose that. And what I usually chose, as I said, what I wanted, I got. And what I realised was that I was powerless, and all these other things in my life, these people, these institutions, whatever they were, principles, they were all higher powers. They were all higher powers. I'd got married, I'd had three children, I'd done all the things that, you know, people do. And none of that had been based on a sober decision. None of it. Not one single thing. I'd never sat down with another human being and looked them in the eye and said, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think? And I certainly never prayed to God or asked God for it, because I just never ran anything by anybody. I just told you what I was going to do, and I went right ahead and did it, regardless. And then couldn't understand why people were upset, why I stepped on the toes of my fellows and they retaliated. And what I see today is that, you know, we say in AA, you know, I'm powerless over people, places and things. And actually I'm not. I can be very powerful over people. I can exert my will. I'm a very manipulative, strong-willed lady. And I can exert my will to a huge degree over people if I choose to do so. That is not God's will for me. That really is not. I can do the same. One of the things I did when I did my second column, step 4 and 5, was, and it's... do you know what I forget to do this sometimes with my sponsees, is to list my resentments against people and also principles and institutions. It gets missed out really, really often. Well, what's a principle? And I must admit, when we went through that bit of the book with my sponsor, it was the things like, you know, a principle is, and it's tied in with institutions, but you know, a principle is just something simple, like when you get a phone bill or you get a gas bill, you pay it. I can remember, and I've never, you know, fortunately to this day, never really lacked earning capacity. I always managed to earn enough. It was never quite enough to drink and use as much as I wanted to, but it was always enough to keep me, you know, clothed and fed and so forth. And I can remember the phone bill would come in, and I'm going back a number of years now. I don't think it was even British Telecom. I don't know what they were called before that, but the phone bill would come in, and it probably wouldn't be that huge, and I would look at it, and I would think, well, I'll wait for the red letter to come in, because we don't have to part with it. No, you know, no sort of thing. And the red letter would come in, and I think, well, it says, like, if you don't pay within 7 days, we're going to cut you off. And I think, well, after 7 days, I might pay it. And it meant going to the post office and queuing up in the, you know, those were the days when it was all not on the internet and everything. It was much more difficult, and I was a busy woman, and I had so much to do, and I didn't have time for, like, minor things like paying bills. And then, like, 10 days on, I'd pick the phone up, and the phone would be cut off. And I would be, there were no mobiles in those days, straight down to that phone box, and you have never heard the tirade. I'm a single parent with a child who has a medical condition. You need to reconnect my phone immediately. And I, you know, and there was a slight element of truth in that. I wasn't in a position where Louis's knees needed the instant access to the phone, but that was my manipulation, and that was my thing. And my sponsor said to me, Yvonne, that's stealing. And I didn't quite get it at first. And it is, it's stealing. They're not charging me for phone calls I might make in 3 weeks' time. They're charging me for phone calls I've already made. The gas board and the electric board aren't charging me for a light I might switch on the week after next. They're charging me for the lights and the cooking and all the rest of it that I've already used. I'd never realised that. I really hadn't. I resented paying the money. And the institution that I had to do my, and this was probably one of the most freeing experiences of step 4 and 5, and it is related into step 11, was my upbringing was within a certain religious denomination. I'm so loath to even mention it because it gets such bad press in AA that I just, you know, my heart breaks really, because it, in all honesty, it didn't really do me that much harm. It was my perception. And there's a lovely phrase in the big book, and what it says is, we miss the beauty of the forest because of the ugliness of some of its trees. And I went to a school, and I was well educated. I came out from school with good qualifications, and I loved school. I loved school, I loved exams, because, you know, I wanted to be the best, and I wanted to achieve, and I had to climb to the top of that heap. But what I remembered when I associated it with my, I mean, it doesn't really matter, it was the Sisters of Providence. I was saying, bloody Providence, but, you know, there wasn't much Providence around when I was at school, and I'd be, you know, really venomous towards these poor ladies. And when we paired it back to the bone, there was actually very little truth in that. There was one nun once that had been really mean to me. She was probably having a bad day, and she'd shouted at me, and because I was such a fearful and timid child, I'd actually wet myself, and I'd never forgotten it. You know, that never, ever, ever will I forget this. And I can remember looking at her and thinking, no one's ever, ever, ever going to do this to me again. But what that did, it wasn't the experience, it was the fact that it completely blocked out Sister Frances, who used to be so lovely, and Sister Margaret, who used to sit and play the guitar and we used to sing, and Sister Agnes, who was kind and sweet and used to cook for us. Forgot all them, absolutely forgot them. And then when it came to the parish priest, there were two. There were Father Kelly, who was the Irish priest who liked a drink, and Father McEwen, who was the Scottish priest, who was obviously not a drinker, was a teetotaler, and I would have said was a really angry man. And I remember going to my first confession at the age of 6, and Father McEwen, and I was really, I remember being in the queue waiting to go in and thinking, please God, as I, you know, I did pray, please God, let it be Father Kelly, let it be Father Kelly. But it wasn't. I got Father McEwen, and I'd made up some old twaddle because I couldn't think of what sins I'd done at the age of 6, and I still can't think what sins children commit at the age of 6, in all honesty, but that's a different matter. And he told me not to, that I was wasting his time, that I didn't have very much to tell him, and I took it so to heart. You know, I was wounded, and that to me, it was, you know, my reaction to just somebody else's opinion was so powerful. It had the power to cut me off and completely disassociate me from God. You know, God never ever for 1 minute of the past, how old am I, 46 years, God has never ever let me go, never. I know that every single day. I never knew this, I never felt it, and I never experienced it, because I was the one who was blocked off, as the speaker said, you know, God wasn't lost, I was. But God was always, always waiting at the door for me. He never closed the door, and I don't believe that he ever will. And my life today is rich. It's rich in peace, and it's rich in contentment, and it's rich in serenity. And sometimes you shouldn't really say that, you know, but I spent my early years in Alcoholics Anonymous doing a kind of, you know, Uriah Heep humility, where I'd kind of, I don't know why I'm happy, and I don't kind of know, oh, I don't know. And I do know, I know why I'm happy, because I have a relationship with God, and today God does for me continually that which I cannot do for myself. You know, I ran the show for 35 years, and it said, you know, that the speaker read it out, and it was really tiring. It was absolutely exhausting running that show, because I had the place and the position and the thing for everybody. I couldn't let you go, because how could I let go? I had nothing or nobody to let go to. I was the ultimate authority in everybody's life that I came into. The power of Eve. And it was really hard work, because people wouldn't stay put. They wouldn't do what I had huge expectations of them and of myself. And as I say, it was like a pack of cards, and it always eventually came tumbling down around me. And all I ever did was move on, find a new set of actors to work with, and rewrite the script again. You know, my step 4 and 5 wasn't exactly a huge sort of thing of 20 years worth. You know, condense the first 5 years, and just, it was a blueprint for what I did for the next 15 years. There wasn't really much that changed, in all honesty. You know, I got worse, but there wasn't much. You know, I from the onset, I was selfish, self-centered, dishonest, resentful, fearful. But I wanted you to like me, and it didn't make for healthy relationships. And what I find today is that I don't run the show. I know I don't run the show. But what I find through taking personal inventory and looking at my part, you know, it's personal. It's about my thinking a lot of the time. You know, there's a lovely reading in, you know, Charlie and Joe call it the big book, and it says, judge not that ye be not judged. And I was so judgmental and so critical, and I can still find that happen today, but I'm uncomfortable with it. And that, you know, that for me is real growth. And I don't even mean, you know, sometimes it's verbalized, but often, more often than not, thank God, it is just in my head. And you know, the other thing, and I mentioned it earlier, is saying to God to direct my thinking. Throughout the day, I ask God to direct my thinking, because my thinking, I haven't suddenly become this, you know, full of spiritual thinking and kind of wanting the love and the well-being of other people. It's not my, there's a lovely setting on my phone that says restore factory settings. I've never pressed it because I don't know, it sounds a bit dodgy. I don't know what might happen to it. But that, you know, my factory setting is mean, selfish and egotistical, absolutely. No, that's what I'm set at. And what God and the steps and the practice of prayer and meditation do for me is they get me out of the way, and they give God that little bit of space, and that's all he asks for. I mean, I know I'm entirely ready to give my will and my life into God's care, but they give me that, it gives me that little bit of space that during the day, you know, the benefits, and I'll say this, and it's not at odds with the earlier speakers, but my practice of meditation, I've never really been taken anywhere with it other than to a place of calm and a place of peace and a sense of just well-being. And what I understand that as, that's the pocket of God's spirit in me. And during the day, when I am faced with indecision, when I am faced with anger, when I'm faced with doubt, when I'm faced with a challenge, that pocket of peace is there, and my spirit taps into it. And sometimes words come out of my mouth and I think, where on earth did that come from? Because it's not really what I wanted to say, or you know, no, not really what I know my factory setting is. You know, my factory setting is vastly different to the person that God has chosen me to grow to be. And I'll finish on this, you know, because what time is it? Oh dear, old age and vanity are terrible things, you know, because it stopped me wearing my glasses today and I can't see what the time is. But last year, on the 27th, this is, you know, my final exam, on the 27th of September last year, it was my husband's birthday. And my husband and I had separated during recent years. But we had maintained and retained a very good friendship. We spent Christmases, birthdays and holidays together. He lived around the corner, and he was, anybody in AA that knew me knew Paul. And it was his birthday on the, I think it was a Tuesday, the 27th of September last year. And for some reason, every birthday, we, whoever's birthday it was, if it was me, if it was him, if it was one of the boys, we picked which restaurant we want. I mean, I don't advise this, because I remember when the kids were little, going out for a birthday meal to McDonald's and things like that. But we picked where we wanted to eat. Doesn't suit my grandiosity at all. We picked where we wanted to eat, and we went for a meal there. And sometimes, I mean, sometimes it was funny, because the boys would pick, you know, little cafes, and we'd go and have fish and chips. And sometimes they'd pick somewhere really, really quite nice and expensive or whatever. But we just went with it. And it was, Paul's birthday was coming up. And on the Sunday, I'd thought about it, and I remembered it's his birthday Tuesday. We'll be going out for dinner Tuesday night. And this little voice came into my head and said, "You've got beyond that now, Yvonne. You know, you've been separated for a while. It's a silly game to play. What do you want to be, you know, pretending happy families and make-believe and whatever for?" And not immediately at that point. I nurtured that thought, and I fed it and watered it for a little while during the course of that day. And as the day went on, I actually thought, I'm going to ring my sponsor. And as I thought that thought, you know, that's the initial thought of admitting almost my powerlessness and my need for some input, a voice just came into me, and all it said, it was, I mean, I'm sure God doesn't probably speak like this, but what it said to me was, "Yvonne, shut up and grow up." So I thought, right, well, there's my answer. You know, my answer is that I don't have to do a big speech to Paul and explain why, for the first time in, you know, nearly 20 years, I'm going to break a family tradition, because I'm so sober and I'm so well, and I don't need to be part of this charade. You know, this was all the head stuff. So we went out on the Tuesday, and we had a lovely meal, and it was very nice. And we all came back to my house and had birthday cake and opened presents, and I drove him home, and it was lovely. And, you know, on the Thursday, Paul came round. He came round most evenings, and he came round at 7:15, and he went to play squash. And at 7:15, he had a massive heart attack, and he died on the squash court. And it was, a dreadful experience for the whole family, for my poor children to be bereft of their dad at such a young age. But, you know, I have nothing. I look back, you know, my thinking would have got me into that selfish, self-centred place where I'm making a decision yet again based entirely on self. There was no reason to want to make that decision. It's just my default thinking, which will tell me that I know best. And it always presents itself as logical, as rational, but it's not spiritual. It's really, really not. You know, I can't rationalise my behaviour. I have to be spiritually in touch with God to do God's will. And it's, you know, it's been okay. It's another part of the journey of life, but I don't look back with regret and with, you know, dreadful sorrow over the part that I've played. And that is all, as I said, you know, I said earlier on, it's not a goal or a race. It's really God's grace, God's loving hand and his kindness. And I think I'll leave it there. So thank you all for listening to me.